This hour's top story is the Yemeni army says it has carried out a retaliatory drone attack on Saudi Arabia, hitting the King Khalid Air Base in the southwest of the country. The U.S. starts to pull out its forces from Afghanistan after almost 20 years in the country. Brazil's coronavirus cases surpass 14.3 million as the South American country's death toll tops 390,000. Those were the top stories. Welcome. This hour's top story, the Yemeni army says it has conducted a retaliatory drone attack on an airbase inside Saudi Arabia. Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Sari said a Qasef 2K drone targeted the King Khalid base in the southwestern Saudi city of Khamis Mashait. The spokesman added that the attack was in response to Saudi Arabia's escalation of aggression and continued siege of Yemen. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have stepped up their retaliatory attacks against the kingdom in the recent months. They're pushing for the lifting of the blockade on Yemen and an end to the war that has killed tens of thousands of people in the Arab nation. Journalist and political commentator Hussein Al-Bakhiti says Saudi Arabia uses the King Khalid Air Base to conduct raids against Yemen.
The Yemeni army in the last 3 to 4 months has focused most of its attack against Saudi air base, especially south of Saudi Arabia, on Khamis Mashait air base. This is one of the largest air base inside Saudi Arabia, and it's located in Asir province, south of Saudi, and is one of the closest and largest air base close to Yemen, and it was one of the main base that's used by Saudi Arabia to target Yemen and as well to force the blockade on Yemen. And I just want to mention that every now and then we see that sometime Yemeni army here in Sana'a target, as an example, Abha Airport and Najran Airport and Jizan Airport, and those airports actually close to Yemeni border as well, and they're considered as a civilian's airport. But because when Saudi actually is using this airport as a military base or to conduct attack and strike against Yemen, we see definitely a direct attack against those airbase.
The U.S. has announced that it has begun withdrawing its troops from Afghanistan. This comes as nearly two decades of American military presence in the Asian country has failed to tackle insecurity and violence. We were earlier joined by our guests in our news review program to discuss that matter.
It's time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. The United States has started to pull its military forces out of Afghanistan after nearly 20 years in the country. Commander of the U.S.-led coalition in Afghanistan, General Austin Scott Miller, confirmed that Washington had begun to withdraw troops from the country in local areas. The top general, however, added that the official date to begin the troop withdrawal would be the 1st of May. U.S. President Joe Biden recently announced that he would pull American forces out of the Asian country in the coming months. This comes as U.S. troops were scheduled to have fully withdrawn from Afghanistan by May 2021. Under a peace accord signed between the Taliban and the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump, the Taliban accused Washington of violating the provisions of the agreement. Joining us is Jim Kavanagh, the founder at the polemicist.net from New York, and we also have Sarah Flounders, activist and commentator, also from New York. Welcome. Jim, if I can start with you, and a bit of a tough question, this one. Research at Brown University suggests or says the invasion and war has cost the U.S. taxpayers $2.26 trillion, and other studies say that's a conservative figure. What has America achieved during these two decades in Afghanistan with that money?
A lot of profit for their weapons manufacturers, basically. This is a political and military defeat. That's the United States is leaving that country. It is likely that the Taliban will certainly have a much greater role in the running of the country, if the government doesn't just completely collapse. And nobody really can tell you what the United States was doing in there. You know, the Al-Qaeda was chased out quickly. Osama bin Laden's been dead for years. This is 20 years. And, you know, there was a great series of articles published in the Washington Post about the Afghan war and how it was just a pack of lies from beginning to end. So, you know, it's a great lesson in how you can spend $2 trillion doing nothing but pumping up the profits of the defense of the weapons manufacturer.
Right. And Sarah, as Jim was alluding to, the United States invaded Afghanistan more than 20 years ago, accusing it of harboring Al-Qaeda and wanting to oust the Taliban. It hasn't done so. But since then, other terror groups have emerged. Al-Qaeda still maintains a presence, according to some. You've got Daesh, for example, which is like Al-Qaeda on steroids, and other terrorist groups that have emerged. I mean, you talk about foreign policy blunders. Where does this one rank?
Well, this certainly ranks as a disaster at every stage from beginning to end, and it always has been a disaster for the people of Afghanistan and for the soldiers here who were sent to fight. And it was never intended to be anything but U.S. domination, strategic control of a country that's potentially fabulously rich in resources. They did want control of those resources. They've utterly failed. And they failed to make any improvement in the conditions of life for anyone in Afghanistan. It's poorer today after 20 years. Literacy rates, infant mortality, and including conditions for women, overwhelmingly, where 80% of the population lives in the countryside. So things aren't better. They failed on every count, but they made a lot of money. And that is absolutely true. The weapons contractors, the military contractors, and that is what they intend to continue, even with all the talk of withdrawal.
Right. So, Jim, based on what Sarah just said, the Americans are leaving Afghanistan in a worse situation than when it invaded. Will it compensate the country? Just like, for example, Iraq is compensating its neighbors for invading them, albeit it was under the former regime of Saddam Hussein when the invasions took place, but until today they're still compensating them. Will they and should they?
Will the United States compensate Afghanistan? If that's the question you're asking, I don't think there's a chance of that. You know, they're going to continue to pay the salaries of the Afghan government and the Afghan soldiers. They're saying that. They're going to pay the salaries of the Afghan army.
But
they're going to hang on.
Pardon me, Jim. The destruction, yeah. I meant that the
right,
destruction
right,
that the United States has caused, for example, like Sorry, I was just going to say the destruction that has caused as a result of the invasion. I don't know, a market in Kabul that hasn't been bombed, will it compensate the Afghans for this destruction and death?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. In terms of reparations and reparative damages to the Afghan people, I don't foresee that happening because I think that Congress would, you know, the United States has this position that the countries who they invade should be grateful that they invaded, we invaded them, and they should pay us, you know, with oil or whatever. And, you know, it's going to be, especially if there's fighting, which there may very well be between after May 1st, you know, the Taliban haven't agreed to this new deadline, the United States, the right wing and the dominant forces in the American government are going to be saying, you know, look at how ungrateful they were. And I don't foresee reparations being paid to Afghanistan for the damage done.
Indeed. I mean, Sarah, Jim raises a very important, valid point that violence is no doubt, perhaps, you know, many say will continue after the United States leaves. But I just want to go back to that figure of $2.26 trillion. I mean, you know, that's money that could have been spent back home on to tackle poverty, to tackle unemployment, to tackle, you know, homelessness. The list is endless.
Well, it's money that could have gone for all those things, but even if they bring troops home, it won't go for those purposes. This is a country where the money goes for the highest rate of profit, which is in the military, oil industries, pharmaceutical industries. It does not go for people's needs right here, and it won't before or after Afghanistan. Military contracts will increase. The military budget is increasing once again for all manner of weapons. So the idea that this would be the rational choice, choices are being made as to what is rational for a tiny handful of the extremely wealthiest stockholders and owners of the top corporations, military, oil, as I say, pharmaceutical, banking. It doesn't go for people's needs here at all.
Let me thank our guests for their time and contribution. Jim Kavanaugh, the founder at the
Polemicist.
Say that again, Jim.
The
Polemicist.net. That was Jim Kavanaugh from New York, and Sarah Flounders, activist and commentator, joining us also out of New York. Thank you very much indeed for that, and thank you for staying tuned to this edition of the News Review.
Welcome back. At least a dozen Afghan policemen have been killed amid ongoing fighting in the violence-racked country. Seven officers lost their lives in an attack Sunday in the province of Logar, south of the capital, Kabul. They were killed in an ambush by the Taliban. In a separate offensive, another five policemen were killed when a suicide bomber ran an explosive-laden car into a police vehicle in the southern Taliban bastion of Kandahar. The attacks come despite the years-long presence of U.S. troops on the ground. Our correspondent Amin Alami says violence is flaring up in Afghanistan despite ongoing diplomatic steps to de-escalate the situation.
Insecurity is on the rise in Afghanistan, while political efforts are also underway to convince the Taliban militant group to return back to the negotiation table and say yes to the Turkey summit that was scheduled to launch on October 24th, but the Taliban militant group boycotted this key summit on the Afghan peace process and said that the main cause behind boycotting Turkey summit is Washington's violation of the U.S. Taliban peace deal that was signed in the Qatari capital, Doha. According to the deal between the U.S. and the Taliban, Washington is responsible to pull out all American forces from Afghanistan by May. But after the declaration of the withdrawal of foreign forces by September 11 this year, the Taliban vowed to resume their plans and strategies in order to have a new look to the relations with the United States, as well as to review the peace deal that was signed between U.S. Representative Zalmay Khalilzad and the Taliban deputy leader Mullah Baradar in the Qatari capital, Doha.
Brazilian officials report over 32,000 new confirmed COVID-19 cases, raising the country's total to more than 14.3 million. Brazil's death toll from the virus also surpassed 390,000 after health authorities reported over 1,300 fatalities in the span of 24 hours. Latest figures come a day after the South American nation hit its record monthly death toll since the pandemic began. Brazil remains the world's second worst affected country in terms of fatalities, followed by Mexico, which has recorded nearly 215,000 deaths so far. On Sunday, the Mexican Health Ministry reported more than 1,600 new confirmed cases of the virus, pushing the country's total to over 2.3 million. The government has, however, said the real number of cases is likely significantly higher. The United States has joined several other Western nations to help coronavirus hit India. U.S. President Joe Biden said Washington is determined to reciprocate the assistance New Delhi provided Washington in the early stages of the COVID-19 outbreak. The Biden administration has been under pressure to provide the Asian nation with its surplus coronavirus vaccines, a move it now says it is considering. The United Kingdom, France, and Germany have also vowed to help. India has set the global record for daily new cases, having logged nearly 350,000 infections. The number of total cases in the world's second most populous nation is now inching closer to 17 million. It also set a new record of deaths, with nearly 2,800 fatalities, pushing the total more than 192,000. Well, since the start of the holy month of Ramadan, Israel has imposed strict measures in Jerusalem and Quds with the aim of exerting further pressure on Palestinians. The pressure led to fierce clashes between Israeli police, that is, and Palestinians in the holy city. Over the past couple of days, Palestinians hold Israel responsible for the clashes and call on the international community to stop Israeli aggression. Mona Canfield has more.
The Palestinian Authority, along with different political factions, held Israel fully responsible for the serious deterioration in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds over the past few days and called on the international community to put pressure on the Israeli regime to stop its provocations. Israeli police and settler violence erupted in the area on Thursday night and continued through Friday, leaving over 100 of Palestinians wounded and scores more arrested.
Since the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, Israeli forces had been escalating measures against the people there, starting by cutting off loudspeakers of Al-Aqsa Mosque. That's why our people in Al-Quds are protesting and rising against oppression and crimes by the Israeli regime.
But the issue is not only between the Israeli police and the Palestinians. Since the start of the holy month of Ramadan, every night hundreds of Israeli settlers rush to the streets of the holy city and assault Palestinians under the protection of the Israeli forces. The extremist settlers chant death to Arabs during their marches. Hundreds of ultra-nationalist Israelis marched through central Jerusalem towards the Damascus Gate, which police had barricaded as a precaution.
Verbal condemnation of Israel over the aggression is not enough. The Palestinian factions must offer all forms of support to Al-Quds and its residents. Palestinians must stand united behind Al-Quds. What's going on is an uprising, and here in occupied West Bank, protests and demonstrations should continue. This is the least we can do to defend Al-Quds.
Palestinians say Israeli police want to prevent them from saying their prayers and the usual Ramadan evening gatherings at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and outside the Damascus Gate.
Protests which flared up in Jerusalem Al-Quds have now spilled over to the occupied West Bank in defense of the Holy City and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians warned that Tel Aviv is heading towards a heavy-handed crackdown against them in the occupied territories to ward off another surge in Palestinians' protests and anger. Mona Kandil for Press TV, occupied Ramallah.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Data acquired and calculated by financial news website FinVault indicates that 10% of the United States upper class account for 69.2% of the country's total household wealth as of fourth quarter of 2020. The country's top 1% richest controls a fortune of $38.91 trillion, translating to 31.4% of the entire household wealth. Another 9% of the rich account for 38.2% of the household wealth at $46.99 trillion. The wealth distribution inequality is exhibited by the bottom 50% class that controls $2.49 trillion of household wealth, or just 2%. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Analysis Shows Richest 10% Now Own Nearly 70% of All Household Wealth in U.S. Here's the details. More than a year after the coronavirus pandemic and the corresponding economic crisis began, a new analysis shows that as 2020 ended, the richest 10% of Americans possess just under 70% of the nation's household wealth. According to the report by financial news website Finbold, which looked at the final quarter of 2020, that top bracket of rich individuals accounted for 69.2% of wealth, including real estate, bank accounts, stocks, and other assets. Nearly half of those assets are concentrated in the wealth of the top 1%, whom own a combined $38.91 trillion. Nearly $47 trillion is owned by the remaining top 9% of rich households. The bottom 50% of earners, meanwhile, control a combined $2.49 trillion or 2% of U.S. household wealth. The analysis comes after a year in which the gap between the wealthiest Americans, who derive far more of their wealth from the stock market than the working poor and the middle-class families, came into stark relief. Markets quickly rebounded after the initial shock of the pandemic. Even as more than 1 million Americans were filing unemployment claims each week at the end of 2020. As the New York Times reported in January, the top 10% of American households control 84% of all Wall Street portfolios' value, while the bottom 50% of earners are more likely to derive their wealth from work. In a country where incomes for most workers have barely grown in four decades, and the federal minimum wage of $7.25 per hour has remained stagnant since 2009. As the pandemic gripped the United States and forced hundreds of thousands of restaurants and other businesses to close in 2020, Finbold's report noted that low-income workers faced furloughs and layoffs, while their counterparts in the middle and upper income brackets were more likely to keep working while avoiding exposure to COVID-19. The lower class mainly comprises service workers who don't have the pleasure of working from home. Finbold editor-in-chief Oliver Scott wrote, "This group comprised the massive job cuts witnessed amid the pandemic. The middle class individuals were able to work from home while retaining their income." The analysis shows a staggering difference between the wealthiest Americans and lower-income Americans, which has grown in the last three decades, Scott wrote. Between the fourth quarter of 1990 and the fourth quarter of 2020, the collective wealth of top 1% grew by 675%, from $5.2 trillion to nearly $39 trillion. Meanwhile, the wealth of the bottom 50% grew by less than $1 trillion to just $2.49 trillion over 30 years. The wealth inequality in the U.S. has been a source of debate for years. Based on the wealth growth rate, there is the view that lower-class people might keep experiencing diminished economic opportunity and mobility. There are also fears that the wealth gap might impact the political influence of the disadvantaged groups. On the flip side, another school of thought is not alarmed by the gap, because the inequality does not harm the economic opportunities. However, the resumption of economic activities will positively affect the wealth distribution, as the lower class might benefit, but not in equal measure to the rich. A booming economy means people can start businesses and will be more willing to spend and save.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and how about reflecting upon what Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has told his disciple, Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari, concerning the benefits of fasting in the month of Ramadan. O Jabir, this is the month of Ramadan, wherein those who fast on its days and spend a portion of its nights in worship, whilst taking care of their bellies and private parts, eschew that which is unlawful, and their tongues are kept in check, come out of their sins as they pass out of the month.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And to help us with these questions, we have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Mighdad, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Almiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Mighdad. It's always nice to have you here. Thank you for coming.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. The pleasure is all mine.
So we're continuing a question we had from last episode. The question read, some of my friends have organized a private Quran tuition class for children, and as per my normal habit, I ask my 7-year-old every time if he wants to go, and many times he doesn't want to go, so I don't take him. The result is that he's fallen quite behind. Am I doing the right thing? Now, in the last class, in the last session, we explained that children have to be registered in classes once they have understood that they are committed when they agree. And we have to explain to them why this class is actually worth registering and the values of the class. And if they want to miss a session, we should ask them to explain their reasons why they want to miss the session, and discuss whether the reasons are valid or invalid. Now, one reason that a child might come up with in regards to why they don't want to continue going to class is that the class is not appealing to them for some reason. It's not fun, it's not exciting, they don't feel like they're getting something valuable or whatever. They don't like it. So what are the features that we should have in a Quran recitation class that would make it enjoyable to children?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, one of the primary things that when we teach Quran to children is obviously the emotional attachment that we're going to have with the Quran. This is amongst the fundamental principles of any Quran class. In fact, our scholars, and based on the traditions that we have, they tell us that the fundamental thing that we need to have with the Quran is a relationship with the Quran. We call this an uns, right? In both Arabic and Farsi as well. To the extent that even memorization of the Quran, the way to recite the Quran, the recitation of the Quran, and all the different things that we talk about the Quran, all of it goes back to this one fundamental point, and that is the relationship that one has to build with the Quran in order to benefit from the Quran, obviously, right? The goal of the Quran is to guide us, and we should be able to benefit from this. The key to benefiting from the Quran is to have a very strong relationship with the Holy Quran. And so from a very young age, when you organize classes for children regarding recitation of the Quran or regarding memorization of the Quran, then these should be focused primarily, or the main central point that comes out from it should be a strong relationship that a child should be building with the Quran.
That's a very, very interesting approach. First time I hear it. Can we say that uns is translated as a companionship?
A kind of relationship, basically.
A kind of relationship where, I mean, it's not just about knowing each other, but acting based on the Quran. Are you suggesting that maybe our Quran classes shouldn't just focus on how we utter the words, but also the teachers should suggest that based on what we just read, how we should behave?
Definitely. The recitation of the Quran is for us to build this relationship, and this relationship is to act upon it, to benefit from it, to get guidance from it. It's a kind of companionship, right? It's to have the Quran as a company with you, and not somebody who you just drag along with you, right? But somebody you interact, in your lonely time, you have the Quran. You have this very beautiful hadith. I'm sure all the listeners have heard this hadith before, is that Imam Sajjad said that if everybody in the whole world were to somehow disappear, paraphrasing the hadith, and if I had the Quran, I would not feel lonely.
That
just me and the Quran would be...
I think that's a very golden rule for everyone to remember. We're going to take a break, so it's a nice place to stop, but we'll be back to further our discussion just after the break. Don't go away.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about how Quran recitation classes should be so that they would be appealing to children. So rule number one was that it's not just about uttering the words of the Quran. The Quran is about companionship, that the target of us and the Quran is to accompany the Quran. So one idea was that the classes shouldn't just be about how we utter the words, but it should also suggest, based on what we've read, how we should behave. In other words, learning life from the Quran as we learn to read it.
For sure, but obviously we should be careful that it should be age-appropriate. Certain things children just can't do or can't act upon. And so it should be things that children would appreciate and be amazed by. One of the things that perhaps I like, for example, to do with the Quran is to tell them stories, right? And you mention the stories, and then you bring about a couple of verses here and there and tell them that this amazing point that we just heard from the story is actually in the Holy Quran, like that, right? So they should be amazed by the Quran. They should appreciate the value of the Quran. So this is something really important in our life, something really valuable, something that we can actually gain a lot from, right? And it never has to be like we've completed the Quran or we've done it, we've heard it before. For example, I remember sometimes you do the story of Prophet Nuh, for example, right? And the first time the teacher comes and says the whole story of Prophet Nuh, right? The second year when it happens in Sunday school, the child comes and says, "Oh, Prophet Nuh, I've heard everything. I don't want to hear it again. I know what happens. The rain comes, the boat comes, and that's it, basically, right?" So it's up to the teacher to be skilled enough to be able to kind of bring another aspect to the story, or bring a bit more depth to the story, or use a couple other words or activities in a way that child feels like, oh, actually there's a lot more to discover.
Okay, thank you very much. What else should we be considerate of when it comes to Quran recitation? I mean, what are some of the fun things that we can add to Quran apart from the story?
So the story is probably one of the fundamental things. It plays a very important role, because story is obviously something that is very appreciated by all of us, young ones and adults as well, right? It touches the heart straight away, and the Quran is, for this particular reason and for other reasons as well, full of stories. Other than the stories, we can play different games that are related to the Quran, whether it's games that are related to words of the Quran, okay, where you build activities, for example, on certain types of words. So you have words that are related to the animal kingdom, for example, words that are related to characteristics, for example, words that are related to the names of the Prophet and names of places, etc. So you can play different games that are related to this particular place. We can make a map, for example. You can draw animals. You can do all these kind of things, basically, that are related to words. Then you have concepts where you can like act out on a couple of stories. You can act out a couple of scenarios, play around with the different concepts that are related to characteristics. There's a whole idea of calligraphy as well, writing the Quran. Unfortunately, I don't think we pay too much attention to this, whilst it's quite important as well. Calligraphy and writing the Quran, doing arts with the verses of the Quran, right? There's a huge science behind how to do this, and something that we need to really start expanding, that we should have our walls filled with this beautiful calligraphy of the Holy Quran, verses here and there.
Some might say that the Quran is a serious book. It has immeasurable respect, and having Quran classes like that is disrespect to the Quran. Is it really disrespect to the Quran?
No, on the contrary, we should be careful not to take this this respect of the Quran on with a lot of exaggeration. So the Quran is very, very, very respect. We need to put a lot of respect on the Quran, for sure. Okay, and we have this in Hadith, obviously, the way you treat the Quran, the way you hold the Quran, the way you kiss the Quran, the way you place it, etc. You have to do with wudu, etc. However, having said all that, there's certain things that we have to be very careful in order to understand what this respect means.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to take a short break now, but we'll be back after the break for more discussions. Don't go away.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about features of Quran classes that are appealing to children and would make them like to participate in those classes. So you were saying that we should not exaggerate the respect of Quran.
See, as I mentioned in the beginning, the goal behind all these classes and our interaction with the Quran is to have a very strong relationship with the Quran. Now, if we take respect in a way that it becomes an obstacle for this relationship, then this respect has no value, right? It's pointless to have so much respect in a way that you... it's like, for example, you take the Quran, I respect the Quran so much, I'm going to put it on top of the shelf, right? So nobody touches it, it never gets, like, dirtied, it's very clean, I'll wash it a couple of times every year. This is kind of pointless, right?
It's quite counterproductive.
Exactly. It's a kind of respect that has no value, basically. So we're told to respect the Quran, but in fact, the respect should be for that relationship, right? So you respect the Quran in a way that actually you feel that you want to have a relationship with him. You feel, the child feels like, my dad gives the Quran so much importance, there must be something really amazing about this, right? So the respect actually is actually a cause for that relationship, not an obstacle for it. So if a child holds the Quran, a child hasn't done wudu and he's holding it and he's running with it, for example, because he wants to say something to his mom, for example, quickly, or he sits down and puts it on the floor so he can draw something about the Quran, okay? It's not for us to come and say, oh, you can't put the Quran on the floor, you can't be running with the Quran. These are all counterproductive. They lead the child to feel like, but I was just coloring it. I just wanted to say something very interesting about the Quran. Like it doesn't actually remove this relationship they want to have with the Quran. No, you should be very careful to... Yes, you teach them that you pick up the Quran. You preferably don't put it on the floor. Maybe have some sort of... They have these things where you have Quran holders, basically, where you put the Quran holder. You prepare the grounds for things to happen in a way that is very respectful. But you make sure that this respect or this instruction to respect the Quran doesn't come as an obstacle for a child to build relationship with the Quran.
Okay, thank you very much. A very quick question with the very short time that we have is that sometimes parents take their children to Quran recitation sessions, and especially if the child is alone or because of the respect of the Quran, children are not allowed to play. Those sessions are very boring to children, and this actually might hurt their relationship with the Quran. Do you think it might hurt their relationship, and is there something parents can do about it?
First and foremost, we should give importance to these sessions, for sure. Recitation of the Quran as a group together is very good, especially encouraging these sessions to become very grand, so you have a very good speaker, a very good Quran reciter. For children, however, one, you give, show them the importance of this, tell them this is very important, okay? Might feel boring, but it's important. Allow them to stay 5 or 10 minutes. And for example, if it's a 1 hour session or if it's a half an hour session, can you sit for 5 minutes? Just so that you can benefit, because there's angels over here, it's a very blessed session. Just sit over here 5 minutes, okay? Quietly, just listen to it, okay? As long as he's done that, then you can say, okay, now you can go play, right? So you've done both, basically. You've shown him the importance of this session, okay? You've allowed him to benefit from these sessions as well. At the same time, you haven't put so much pressure on the child that it feels bored and dissociated and feels kind of annoyed and frustrated, and that frustration goes back to the Quran.
Antagonistic towards the Quran. Thank you very much. That's all the time that we have, unfortunately. If you missed this episode, no worries. You can always download an archive of this session and all our previous sessions from our website, Pars Today. You can also email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next program, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The light.
Barcelona's famous Casa Batel has been decorated with hundreds of artificial red roses on the occasion of St. George's Day, a Christian celebration also known as the Feast of St. George. For those in Catalonia, the floral decoration of Antoni Gaudí's architectural masterpiece means the arrival of spring. Many locals say that after a year of lockdown amid pandemic, the decoration seems like a recovery for them. Catalans normally celebrate the occasion in large groups outdoors, but this year, COVID-19 has prevented their traditional way of celebrations. However, they say Casa Batel's roses have sparked a sense of enthusiasm that life is eventually going back to normal in some way. A Dutch photographer has captured stunning footage of a super yacht passing through narrow canals of the Netherlands. Tom van Usanen used a drone to record the transportation of the gigantic vessel from its initial facility to the North Sea. The 94 meters long yacht, known as Project 817, is one of the largest vessels to be launched this year. It has been designed to precisely fit the waterways, and even a few centimeters cannot be added to its length or width. The duration of the yacht's transportation also depends on a variety of factors, including winds and the schedule of the bridges. For this super yacht, the mission took 4 days to be completed. Space radar capable of capturing small objects that threaten the safety of astronauts and satellites has been inaugurated at a farm in northwestern Costa Rica. The four large panels that make up the radar are connected to the servers of an aerospace company in San Francisco in the U.S. state of California. The system uses a continuous series of radio frequencies that bounce off materials in orbit and send information back to the servers. An American astronaut present at the ceremony says the radar is most advanced of its kind in the world.
Now, this radar, which is the most advanced commercial radar
for space tracking in the world. What it does is it sends radio signals into space. As Franklin said, even an object the size of a golf ball traveling at 30,000 kilometers per hour overhead, a tiny amount of those radio waves will bounce off it and can be picked up by these giant reflector dishes behind us.
Costa Rican President Carlos Alvarado also joined by American and domestic astronauts during the event. The radar can monitor objects that transit in low Earth orbit near the equator, an average or an advantage offered by Costa Rica's geographical location.
A museum in London has transformed its gift shop into a mini supermarket selling artist-designed food to help an industry largely affected by the coronavirus pandemic. The Design Museum has reopened its shop with the help of 10 artists. It sells essential products with packaging designed by emerging artists. The market offers goods at the same price of normal markets, both online and at a marketplace. The initiative is led by Camille Walala, who says her project is aimed at supporting the artists reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, the project is to support artists, and I think because obviously at the moment there's no exhibition, people can't really show any of their creative work, and it's nice to have like a feedback when you're creative. It's nice to know, you know, if people like your work. I think this is a really nice platform to just bring artwork on like everyday product, and actually people are going to probably come and just buy them and probably keep them as a piece of art, like, you know, an affordable piece of art from some artist that you like. I think it's a really nice way to display art, so yeah, I think.
Walala says the project also conveys the message that creativity is as important for living as the other essentials. She says the creative supermarket will also help the museum, which has seen a drop of more than 90% in income because of the pandemic. The shop is open for just 5 days, but artists expect heavy demand. In Hong Kong schools, robots are helping children with autism to live a better life. These robots are part of an educational program called Robot for Autism Behavioral Intervention, or RABI. It's designed for individuals with autism between 3 and 18 years of age and aims to make them more social. The robots engage the children with role-playing and verbal interaction, helping them to resolve issues such as conflicts and bullying. The program was developed by a Hong Kong professor, Catherine So. She says the program will help fight social deprivation of a certain group of people.
We would believe that RABI can help them to, you know, improve their social and behavioral skills, and in turn, enhancing their quality of their life. So to reduce being excluded in the society, and also help them to be included in the future.
Catherine says using robots also helps keep the program structured and predictable, as autistic people are hypersensitive to voices and facial expressions. The program she launched in 2015 has now been adopted in more than 20 nonprofit groups and public schools in the country. More than 1,200 children have used it so far.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trendy news, and more from every corner of the world.
The worldwide trends show people rapidly moving toward modern vehicles now, especially electric cars. But Parisians saw a very unusual kind of EV driving around the city, similar to the one people were using over a century ago. A replica of the 1881 vehicle by French inventor Gustave Prouve was made to celebrate what is regarded as the 140th anniversary of the first viable electric car. Drove, who is believed to have driven the world's first electric car, combined a rechargeable battery and a cycle, something very similar to a modern e-bike. The car has a motor to assist you, but you can still pedal at the same time.
So Gustave Trouveau, when he combined an electric motor, a rechargeable battery and a cycle very similar to this one, that would be one of the earliest, if not the earliest, electric vehicle to be seen on the roads.
A Victorian cycle engineer built the vehicle in North Yorkshire, England. It took him some 2 months to come up with the replica with materials that closely match those used by Trouveau himself. Like the original, it has an average speed of approximately 16 kilometers per hour. NASA's small helicopter has made history as it successfully completed its flight on Mars. Receiving instructions from Earth, Ingenuity managed to rise to about 3 meters, hovered for 30 seconds, and then landed on the red planet. The mission marked the first powered, controlled flight on another planet. The helicopter weighs only 1.8 kilograms, has four legs, and is powered by solar panels. Flying a helicopter on Mars is hard because there is not much air to push against to generate the necessary lift. Creative artist in Belgium has come up with an alternative to the face masks, a portable oasis. Alain Vercheron says the mini greenhouse allows him to connect with people while observing social distancing during the coronavirus pandemic. However, the idea is not new. It came to his mind 15 years ago, inspired by the lush oasis he encountered while working in Tunisia.
An oasis is a place of calm, tranquility, cool and well-being in the desert. Here, the fact of having an oasis containing medicinal plants means I am also protecting myself from harm coming from the outside, just like I could at an oasis in the middle of the desert.
Doesn't that look bizarre? Well, he says he has asthma and breathing with the device is easier than a face mask. The 61-year-old artist hopes his invention also raises awareness of environment protection. Pumas are solitary animals that do not usually get along well with humans. However, a Russian family has been living with an extraordinarily friendly mountain lion for 5 years. Now, Alexander and Maria Dmitriev bought little Messi from a zoo 5 years ago. The cat could barely walk then. With the tender care of the couple, he soon regained his strength. Messi's growth was stunted due to his malnutrition. Interestingly, the adorable puma has never shown any aggression toward humans. Well, looks very friendly. Messi's family has converted their home to meet his natural needs. They have also set up social media accounts for him on Instagram and YouTube, where he has millions of followers.
Malaysian farmers tap classical music and massages to grow one of the world's most expensive fruits, Japanese muskmelons. The farmers believe the method is the best way to grow Japanese muskmelons in Malaysia's hot tropical weather. They regularly rub the melons with a soft cloth or glove. That's a practice, the farmers say, enhance the melon's flavor. To stimulate their growth, classical music is played in greenhouses. And now, all these efforts have paid off following constant trials. The farmers are finally selling their prized luxury fruits of labor on the market.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.